Welcome back to the second half of our 60-second episode, although it is not 60 seconds in length. I don't... Go figure that out. Anyway, hi, how was your break?
It was fine, thanks. How was yours?
It was wonderful.
All right, so it's time for another of a series of occasional trivia questions. Ooh. Here. One of the actors featured in Starship Troopers, and that was a deliberate choice of words, by the way, featured, has the distinction of playing Matt Damon's father in two movies. Would you like to know more? Well, I'll have the answer of who the actor is and what the movies are at the end of this half of the episode. But right now, Claude's going to give us the plot description for Starship Troopers.
Yes, it is the distant future. And over the course of the film, we learn that the veterans of a galactic war overthrew the world's governments and set up a military regime where the society is broken into two groups. Ordinary civilians who live in relative peace, and citizens, you got to say it with a capital C, son, who are comprised entirely of veterans. You need to be a citizen to vote or to run for public office, and it's suggested that it's easier to get a permit to have children if you're a citizen. So this global federation of Earth is in, let's call it, a tense diplomatic position with aliens who live on the planet Klandathu, which is literally on the other side of the galaxy. They're referred to as the arachnids, or more commonly bugs, because they look like huge insects. Got all that? Cool. Let's move on to the film itself. After a little bit of setup information provided by the Global Federation's propaganda network, we are taken live to a reporter who is broadcasting from the middle of a battle. The reporter is killed by one of the bugs while on camera, and the transmission cuts short when a soldier tells the cameraman, "Get out of here." We get a title card that rolls back the clock 1 year. So, we've got Johnny Rico, who's played by Casper Van Dien, his girlfriend Carmen, who is played by Denise Richards, and their best friend Carl, played by Neil Patrick Harris, are about to graduate from their high school in Buenos Aires. We get a few scenes of their lives in class, including a class in history and moral philosophy taught by Mr. Razchak, who is played by Michael Ironside. He's a citizen who drills the students on their responsibilities to their society. Carmen and Carl enlist in the military so they can become citizens. Johnny, well, he really just wants to follow his girlfriend and his friends, so he goes against his parents' desires and also enlists. But he finds that his grades are too low to join Carmen in flight school, so he is assigned to mobile infantry, while Carl, who apparently has some level of ESP, joins military intelligence. In boot camp, Johnny and the rest of the new recruits are drilled by the career sergeant, Zim, who is played by Clancy Brown. Johnny turns out to be an outstanding leader, and he is made leader of his squad. Another of Johnny's high school classmates, Dizzy Flores, played by Dina Meyer, she joins Johnny's unit ostensibly because the unit is the toughest, but also because she's been infatuated with Johnny since they were in high school. Over the next few weeks in boot camp, Johnny learns that Carmen is happy with her training, and she's been working with his high school rival, Xander, who's played by Patrick Muldoon. She sent him a message telling him that she's decided to go career, and that pretty much means the end of their romance. After a training incident in which one of his squad members is killed, Johnny is demoted from squad leader and publicly flogged in accordance with military law. We get a nice moment from Sergeant Zim during this scene where he gives Johnny something to bite down on because he knows personally that it helps with dealing with the pain. Despite having taken his licks, Johnny is still humiliated and calls home to tell his parents he'd like to return to Argentina. But during the video call, the transmission gets cut off. It turns out that the bugs have directed an asteroid at Earth, which destroyed Buenos Aires and killed millions of people. As a result of this sneak attack, Earth declares war on the bugs and Johnny reconsiders his decision to quit. The Federation's forces mount a large-scale invasion of Klandathu, which turns out to be an unmitigated disaster. There's a type of bug that can discharge plasma energy into space, and the intelligence that the fleet has is that there's not expected to be much resistance from those bugs. But the bugs are out in huge numbers, and the fleet takes an enormous amount of damage. On the ground, the mobile infantry on the surface is cut off from air support, and they're overcome by swarms of thousands of bug warriors. This is essentially where the film began, and we see the reporter die again from a different angle. Over 100,000 troops are killed before a retreat can be performed, and several of Johnny's fellow recruits are killed. Johnny himself is badly wounded, and we're not 100% clear how he was evacuated. Later at the Ticonderoga Battle Station, where the remains of the fleet are docked, Carmen spots a casualty list scrolling on a computer screen. Over 300,000 casualties resulted from a single day's battle, most of them killed in action. There are very few wounded. Carmen looks up Johnny Rico's name and, due to an error in the casualty list, believes he's dead. In truth, he's in the care of the medical squad and is having the wound in his leg repaired. Federation scientists are confused by the bug's use of military tactics and postulate that there must be a cast of brain bugs that serve as generals for the arachnids. We get a scene from the Global Federation Network where two people are debating this, and the tenor of their conversation would not be out of place on TV today, frankly. After a few days, Johnny, Dizzy, and fellow squad member Ace Levy, played by Jake Busey, are reassigned to the Roughnecks, a special unit of mobile infantry which they quickly learn is led by Johnny and Dizzy's old high school teacher, Lieutenant Raschek, who has been brought out of retirement to lead the group. We also learn that Raschek is somehow responsible for Johnny's rescue. Back on Earth, a new Sky Marshal revises the campaign, using strikes on other planets in the Klondathu system to learn more about the arachnids' tactics. After aerial napalm strikes against the planets, Lieutenant Raschek's squad lands on Planet P to lead a ground assault. Johnny's leadership and his skill in destroying a tanker bug, which is essentially a bug devoted to behaving like a giant flamethrower, earn him field promotion to corporal. That night, Lieutenant Raschek grants the unit rest and relaxation, during which Johnny and Dizzy wind up in bed. The Roughnecks are assigned to investigate an outpost on Planet P, and they find the garrison wrecked and learn that the bugs have sucked out the brains of some of the dead. They find the commanding officer, General Owen, played by Marshall Bell, still alive, cowering in a closet and rambling about the existence of some kind of leader bug responsible for the massacre. Suddenly, the outpost is ambushed by thousands upon thousands of warrior bugs, with some tanker and flying bugs in support. Most of the squad is killed, including General Owen and Lieutenant Raschek. Johnny takes command and requests an evacuation ship, which happens to be flown by Carmen and Xander. Moments before pickup, Dizzy is stabbed by a warrior bug and she dies in Johnny's arms. After Dizzy's funeral aboard a starship, Johnny and Carmen are joined by Carl, who is now a high-ranking colonel in military intelligence. Carl admits that the Roughnecks had been used as bait to test the theory of the existence of brain bugs that control much of the arachnid behavior. Carl assigns the Roughnecks to search for a brain bug back on Planet P. Carl gives Johnny a promotion to lieutenant and command of the Roughnecks. As the Roughnecks explore the surface of the planet, the fleet in space is again fired upon by hundreds of planetary tanker bugs. During the attack, the warship Roger Young, on which Carmen is stationed as a pilot, is hit by arachnid plasma fire, and it is cut in two. Carmen and Xander manage to evacuate in an escape pod that crashes deep inside a bug nest several meters underground. Johnny learns of Carmen's situation and tells the rest of the squad to keep scouring the system of caves that they've been patrolling while he, Ace, and Sugar Watkins, who is played by Seth Gilliam, search for Carmen in the tunnels. Johnny gets a hunch as to their location, and we learn later on that it was Carl's telepathy that helped guide him. Or maybe not. Carl's not telling. Carmen and Xander are being held by the bugs when the brain bug emerges. It extends a sharp appendage and jams it into Xander's head, sucks out his brain. Carmen saves herself by injuring the bug with a knife that Xander slipped to her earlier. And it's about this time that Johnny, Ace, and Sugar discover them. Johnny holds up a high-energy explosive, which the soldiers refer to as a nuke, that gives them time to grab the wounded Carmen and go. But the bugs begin to pursue them through the caves, and Sugar decides to sacrifice himself to wipe out the bug nest with the nuke. Johnny, Ace, and Carmen arrive on the surface and learn that the brain bug has been captured by the mobile infantry led by former Sergeant Zim, who got himself busted down to private in order to take place in combat. As everyone celebrates, Carl joins Johnny and Carmen on the surface, explaining that they'll be able to learn how the bugs think and then can turn the tide of the war. The film closes with another propaganda bit from the Global Federation Network, and we see that Johnny, Ace, and Carmen are continuing their service in the military as heroes, Johnny is the leader of the Roughnecks, Carmen is the captain of her own ship, and Carl is involved with experiments on the brain bug. And the war shows no sign of ending, despite the network promises.
Okay, so this is based on a novel by Robert Heinlein.
Mm-hmm.
Heinlein, along with Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, and Arthur C. Clarke, is considered one of the top science fiction writers who emerged after World War II, and among the top of all time, and among the top of what gets called hard science fiction. Now, this is a simplistic definition, but hard science fiction basically comes down to almost everything in the novel or in the movie is real or realistic or based on something real, with maybe one or two things that are supposed to be advanced. And while they're not likely, they may at least be plausible.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Right. I mean, there's at least a basis in existing science for whatever they happen to write. And, you know, it's unfortunate that sometimes we discover, well, you know, Jupiter's got way more than 12 moons or something like that. But the fact is, what they knew at the time is what they used for their stories.
Right. As opposed to something that's quote-unquote sci-fi, which is pretty much fantasy. But anyway, Starship Troopers is considered by Heinlein fans to be one of his very best novels, right up there with Stranger in a Strange Land, which I have not read.
For shame. I'll be sending you a copy.
I have read a couple other of Heinlein's novels. I've read The Puppet Masters and Job, Comedy of Justice, which is my favorite of his that I've read. And I tried reading Friday once and couldn't get into it. But I always felt that while Starship Troopers was well written, it is basically a science, for me anyway, a science fiction version of Sands of Iwo Jima. Now, there are people who would go much further than I would. They believe that Starship Troopers and Heinlein in general, at least starting in the 50s, was proto-fascist. Now, I wouldn't go that far, but Heinlein fans would say anyone who accuses Heinlein in general and Starship Troopers in particular of being fascist are missing the point. But it is definitely very pro-militaristic.
Mm-hmm.
And pro a lot of other things, like corporal punishment is good, and only people who, you know, serve in the military or serve in society in some way should be allowed to vote.
Right.
You know, things like that. And why they decided that it would be, why the people who made this movie decided it would be a good idea to give that material to a Holocaust survivor as a director and tell him, yeah, do whatever you want with it, and think that they would get something resembling what Heinlein wrote is beyond me. But nonetheless, that's what we get here. Now, this all did start under relatively innocuous terms. Ed Neumeier, who wrote the screenplay for the movie and also wrote the screenplay for RoboCop, which was Paul Verhoeven's second English language movie. He, Neumeier, and the producer of or one of the producers of RoboCop, John Davison, wanted to work together again. So Neumeier wrote a screenplay called Bug Hunt at Outpost 7, and Davison read it, and he said, and he told Neumeier, you know, this sounds a lot like Starship Troopers. And Neumeier had read the novel, but not in a while. So he read it and he agreed, yeah, it sounds like Starship Troopers. So they bought the rights. And then Neumeier changed his script around to make it a little closer or to the novel. And then they approached Verhoeven. And as I said, Verhoeven is a Holocaust survivor, or a World War II survivor, it should say. The Netherlands did have a lot of Nazi collaborators, but it was also bombed to hell and back by the Nazis as well. And a lot of people were rounded up and put in camps there. Of course, Jews, but also anyone who is rebelling against. So his view of war is decidedly different than Heinlein's. And he tried reading the novel, hated it, told Neumeier to describe it to him, but then decided to do the movie. And as he told Michael Ironside, who mentioned in a later interview, why are you doing a pro-fascist movie? Because Ironside had worked with him on Total Recall, along with a couple other actors who are in this movie, Marshall Bell and one other actor in it as well. I forgot who, but he knew Verhoeven's background and he was curious as to why Verhoeven would make this. And Verhoeven said, if I made a movie showing being anti-fascist, no one would watch it. So what I'm going to do is show a perfect fascist society, except the only thing they're good for is killing bugs. And unfortunately, the movie, as I mentioned at the top, was not a hit with audiences or with a lot of critics. You know, Ebert didn't like it. Siskel did, but mostly because he thought it was entertaining to watch on a big screen. He didn't really pick up on what Verhoeven was doing. And there were even some critics who accused Verhoeven of making a pro-fascist movie. And again, that is decidedly not what he was doing. He was taking the novel, or what he perceived to be the proto-fascist part of the novel, and turning it on its head, not just in the fact that you know, as he said, the only thing these folks are good for are killing bugs, but in also the imagery of the movie. I mean, if you thought George Lucas really went full Triumph of the Will in the awards ceremony at the end of Star Wars: A New Hope, that's nothing compared to what Verhoeven does in this movie. You'll notice that a lot of the actors in the movie, not just Casper Van Dien, but also Jake Busey and Neil Patrick Harris, are blonde and blue-eyed. And when you hear that some of them come from Argentina, you might think, okay, well, why are they casting blonde, blue-eyed people from South America instead of ethnically appropriate? Let's remember that when they fled, the Nazis who were able to flee Germany after World War II, where did they settle in? South America.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one satiric thing that Verhoeven is presenting here. or one way he's presenting the satire. He also used a lot of what he called Hollywood propaganda movies made during World War II. And yes, even though we were fighting Hitler, the movies that Hollywood was making, even though, you know, they were on the side of against Hitler and of good, there were still propaganda, even though there were propaganda for the right side, we hope. So he was using that as a to be satiric.
Right. And those propaganda films, we should note, especially when you're looking at the Japanese, they were racist as hell. And, yes. and that's an important component of it, because if only because you get some of that language kind of creeps into this story here when they're talking, like, the only good bug is a dead bug, that kind of thing. Yes. But also, I would argue, the scene with the two people on TV debating whether or not there's a brain bug, and the one guy who's just like hysterical about, oh, the idea of a brain bug absolutely offends me. I think he's presented as like stereotypical gay character. And in that respect, again, because you're behaving like this and you are postulating that there is a smart bug, well, you cannot possibly be a manly man.
Yes. And then there's also the little sort of commercials that appear throughout the movie, which is something that Verhoeven also did in RoboCop, which is why a lot of people see that as satirical as well as a good action movie. So he's doing a lot here to take the piss out of fascism here. Now, one debate that sprung up among fans of the movie is who exactly of the cast members is in on the joke. Now, Neil Patrick Harris is obviously, you can safely say, is in on the joke. And it's been argued that Michael Ironside and Clancy Brown are also in on the joke. And I would argue that Dina Meyer is probably in on the joke. Whereas even though Casper Van Dien has done interviews where he said, yes, I know it was a satire, you don't get that impression watching the movie that he's necessarily in on the joke. And there have been people who have said the same thing about Denise Richards, although I would argue that after this movie, some of the movies that she appeared in have a similar tongue-in-cheek approach to the material. And I'm thinking about movies like Wild Things, which was a tongue-in-cheek look at erotic thrillers. The World Is Not Enough, even though it is one of my least favorite Bond movies, is definitely supposed to take a somewhat, is still sort of caught between doing something more serious and doing something tongue-in-cheek. And then, of course, there's Undercover Brother, which is a tongue-in-cheek look at blaxploitation movies. So you'd have to say that she's sort of like Margaret Dumont, I would say, in that, you know, she's treated as someone who doesn't get the joke, but I would argue that she's a little, maybe a more smarter than everyone believes,
or that she lets on. It's possible. It's just kind of funny because both the book and the film suggest that you have to be very, very smart to become a pilot. All right. It's expressed in the film as you've got to be, you know, you have to have very high math scores. In the book, it's just basically like women are better at this sort of thing. It's a very sharp divide. Like the men go out and shoot things. The women are the pilots. Okay. Because they have the aptitude, they have the smarts for it, blah, 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 that kind of thing. So you've got that where you've got Denise Richards as Carmen, but then you've also got her as Christmas Jones in The World Is Not Enough. And in both of the, she's a nuclear physicist, really? And so in that case, you're not really buying her as a smart person. You don't have to see her as an especially smart person in Starship Troopers, but she does have to. But she is presented as a very capable pilot, and maybe even a little bit crazy. I think is a word they use a few times.
Well, actually, when I watched this movie with commentary by Verhoeven and I can't remember if it was Neumeier or Davison who joined him in the commentary. Apparently, test audiences hated her character the most.
Hmm.
And Verhoeven, ironically, or so he says, thought that she was pretty much a feminist character, you know, that she's choosing a career mm-hmm. over a relationship.
Sure.
And that she is very capable. And there was supposed to be a more explicit storyline about her moving on with Patrick Muldoon's character, Xander, but test audiences hated that. And so it's only implied rather than shown. And as a matter of fact, the test audiences wanted her to die instead of Dizzy. And that while that does talk of the misogyny of mainstream American audiences at the time, you know, I don't know if I'd go as far as Verhoeven in saying that she's a fully realized feminist character. But yes, I do think that she is written as a capable pilot mm-hmm. and she is someone who is able to use her wits in that, you know, when she's been captured by the bugs, she's able to use Xander's knife to escape. So that's yes. Although, as I said, she's not the I don't know if she's the feminist character that Verhoeven thinks she is, but she is definitely capable.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, she is, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But
right now, Verhoeven would argue that, you know, as far as American audiences go and American actors go, that they are much more repressed about nudity and sexuality than they are about violence. And I'm speaking, of course, here about the shower scene. Now, that was also something that he ran into trouble with audiences. And although he had Final Cut, even studio executives were a little uneasy about it. And some of the actors, you'll notice that Carmen is not in the shower scene because Richards flat out refused to do it.
But she wasn't there.
No, but her character was initially written in it, but involved in it somehow, and she said, "No, I'm not doing it."
Yeah, so that just doesn't make sense because it was during boot camp that showers, unless it got moved to the boot camp scene.
Yeah, it did get moved to the boot camp scene.
Okay,
and you know, Richards, interestingly enough, did go through boot camp with the other actors because she felt that she should do that. But what ended up happening was Dina Meyer, when Verhoeven was trying to talk the other actors into getting nude, said, "Why don't you do it?" So both he and Jost Vacano, who were the cinematographer, agreed to get nude to shoot the scene, and that relaxed everyone. And so that's how they did it.
It is kind of interesting, though, and you know, not that I'm mentioning this for prurient reasons specifically, but I've seen this film several times because it's like kind of talking lamp movie for me at this point. So it's like when I need you know, a little bit of distraction from the TV, but I'm working on something. If I see Starship Troopers is on, I'll actually put it on just to have something on in the background. So I've seen this film many times, not always in its entirety, or at least not all at once from beginning to end.
I have only seen it twice.
Okay. But during the shower scene, it is kind of interesting, though, that while you do, I mean, you see everybody basically, for the most part, from the waist up. There's a couple of, you know, naked butts and that kind of thing. But a lot of times, with the exception of Dina Meyer, the women are somehow partially covered, like they've got their hands like up to wash their face or their hair or something like that. So their elbows are sort of blocking their breasts, that sort of thing. And it's not to say that you don't see their breasts, but it seems to be like, you know, they're kind of being a little bit coy about it. And then Meyer comes in and she's like, "Hi, everybody, here are my breasts." And it's just kind of an interesting thing because we also get her later on during the scene where she and Johnny finally make love and she pulls her shirt up and he grabs her hand so that the shirt sticks over her face and she's left with her hands up over her head. And so we get this kind of a male gaze lingering shot of almost topless Dina Meyer making out with, you know, with Casper Van Dien. And I just found that kind of interesting is like, even though they had the reassurances that you've got people off camera who are also nude, yeah, there's still a little bit of playing coy with the bits and bobs, as they say.
Well, we are talking. Well, Verhoeven would argue that that's Hollywood for you, or yeah, that's America for you. Though I should say that the movies that he did that were intended to be the most sexually explicit, and yes, I'm in America, and yes, I'm talking about Basic Instinct and Showgirls. The former I find absolutely ridiculous. The latter I find idiotic. And I know there are people who think they're both camp classics. I am not one of them. Although I would also lay a lot of the blame at Joe Esterhaas, who wrote those movies, both of those movies, and that the more sexually explicit movies that he's done in Europe, and I'm thinking of movies like The Fourth Man, which is what Basic Instinct only wishes it was, or the sexually explicit parts of Black Book, which along with Soldier of Orange, I think is his best movie, and Bernadetta, his non-sploitation movie. None of those movies feel ridiculous or, I would say, prurient at all. They all feel natural. And certainly Elle, the movie he did with Isabelle Huppert, where she plays someone who gets raped, those scenes are not prurient at all. They're handled seriously. So I think this is, he does have a point about this is how it is in Hollywood and America. Though, again, do not take that as an endorsement of Basic Instinct or Showgirls, because it isn't.
Because they're just, no, they're not, just not that good.
No. Now, we should note that there are a couple of TV veterans in here, in addition to the folks who have worked with Verhoeven before, like Marshall Bell and Michael Ironside. The biology teacher of the class that Johnny and the others are in is played by none other than a barely recognizable Rue McClanahan.
Yes, indeed.
Who is best known, of course, for her turn as Blanche on Golden Girls. And then, as you mentioned, among the cast members is Seth Gilliam, who, of course, we both know from The Wire. Mm-hmm. And then finally, another cast member that we're both familiar with, and that's the woman who is Carmen's captain on the ship that she is piloting. And Captain Deladier, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I think it takes the French, Deladier.
Deladier. Yeah. She's played by Brenda Strong, who we both know as Sally Sasser on Sports Night, and she's good in a limited limited screen time role. And then another actor who, of course, is a TV actor who I just remembered is Dean Norris, who most people will he plays a commanding officer, mm-hmm. and most people, of course, will know him from Breaking Bad. And is he also on the spinoff Better Call Saul?
You know what? I don't know. I waited for Breaking Bad to end to watch it, and I waited for Better Call Saul. So it's in my to-be-seen list. But a quick look at IMDb says, yes, he does two episodes of Better Call Saul.
Okay. So, but he's most famous for Breaking Bad. And generally speaking, as I said, even if you can't quite agree with who's in on the joke and who isn't, I think the acting works for this movie. You know, even if I wouldn't necessarily watch a lot of these actors in other movies, Casper Van Dien, of course, has made a lot of faith-based movies since then, which again leads me and others to wonder if he really did understand the joke in this movie. But they are all functional as far as this movie goes, I would say.
Yeah, and there were sequels to Starship Troopers, and he was in at least one of them. I think there are like four Starship Troopers films altogether, and he was in the third one, I know for sure. There was one night, like, cable was showing like all the movies back to back to back, and again I just had it on while I was doing something else, and every now and then would look up, and I do remember seeing him in another film, not Starship Troopers. So he's done other Starship Troopers movies, and the other films, not really worth it, frankly.
Well, there's been four movies, and then there was a short called Starship Troopers Deadlock. And then there was also a TV series, I don't know if it's a spinoff or what, called the Roughnecks Starship Troopers Chronicles.
Hmm.
But I myself have not seen any of them. I only saw this movie. And we should mention, of course, that this movie is quite violent.
Yeah.
You know, to paraphrase what Pauline Kael once said about Sidney Lumet, no one was ever put to sleep by Paul Verhoeven's good taste. But at least I don't think this way. You know, I didn't think it's about RoboCop or Total Recall, which are my two favorites of his Hollywood movies that he's done. And I certainly don't feel this way about Soldier of Orange or Black Book, that I never felt that the violence here was gratuitous. You know, it was always trying to make a point. I mean, it is graphic and it is gory, but it fits.
Oh, to be sure. I mean, you see people getting torn in half repeatedly. You see people getting, you know, shot to death on camera. You see, you know, and then there are scenes of like post-battle shots. And some of it is part of the propaganda footage that they're showing the folks back at home.
Yes.
And like, here's all the dead people. And you see, again, people just like limbs missing and bleeding out and torn apart and whatever else. And here's what our mobile infantry is doing for you folks at home. And,
yes.
And, but you're right. It none of it is gratuitous. It all has, you know, some kind of point to it.
Yes.
And in some cases actually advances the plot a little bit.
Yes. This is not Hacksaw Ridge,
right,
for example, of a movie, for me anyway, that is clearly gratuitous and getting off on the violence it's showing.
Yeah, it's funny you use that phrase specifically, because most people refer to that as like torture porn.
Yes. So is there anything you want to add before I answer the trivia question?
I do, yes. In fact, I saved this for the end because it was something that Heinlein had put into the book, and I thought it was kind of important. But Carmen's ship is referred to as, it's the Roger Young, okay? And at the very end of the book, Heinlein does a little biography of Roger Young. He was a private in the 148th Infantry, 37th Infantry Division. That's the Ohio Buckeyes. He was born in Tiffin, Ohio in 1918, and he died July 31st, 1943, on the island New Georgia, Solomon's, South Pacific, while single-handedly attacking and destroying an enemy machine gun pillbox. His platoon had been pinned down by intense fire from this pillbox. Private Young was wounded in the first burst. He crawled toward the pillbox, was wounded a second time, but continued to advance, firing his rifle as he did so. He closed on the pillbox. He attacked and destroyed it with hand grenades, but in so doing, he was wounded a third time and killed. His bold and gallant action in the face of overwhelming odds enabled his teammates to escape without loss, and he was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. That's who Roger Young was.
Okay, and I should mention that aside from the tone of the movie, which is radically different from the tone of the novel, the changes that were made from novel to film are Dizzy.
Oh, they're let's just say they're wholesale changes. There's really very little plot in the film that appears in the novel. I mean, Dizzy is male, first of all.
And, yes, I was going to say.
And dies at the beginning.
I think there are things in the novel that are in the movie, but the most substantive changes, aside from the tone and besides the gender flip for Dizzy, Carmen and Rico are not a couple in the novel.
Right.
Rico gets flogged for a different reason in the movie. In the novel, he's flogged for striking a superior officer, whereas in the movie, he's flogged for getting someone in his unit killed.
Right. Somebody else gets flogged for that, and he faints during the flogging.
Yes. And Rico's family does not get killed in the novel. So right. His motivations for getting into the fight are different in the movie.
Right. That's because Buenos Aires does get destroyed, but Rico himself is Filipino. So okay. The family's not even in Argentina.
So, anyway, let's get to the trivia question that I mentioned at the beginning.
Yes, please.
The man who does the voice of the commercials that are shown throughout the movie, and who, as I obliquely indicated when I asked the trivia question, always ends those commercials with, "Would you like to know more?" He's played by an actor by the name of John Cunningham. Now, you might know him also from TV. He's appeared a lot on Law and Order and its spinoffs, but he also has done some movies, and as I said, he's played Matt Damon's father in two movies, and those movies are from 1988. Oh, he's the FedNet announcer is his role in this movie. And those two movies are from 1988, Mystic Pizza, which is Matt Damon's first movie, and he only has one line in the movie. He says, "Mom, what's this green stuff?" at a family dinner that Damon and Julia Roberts, who plays the girlfriend of Damon's brother in the movie, are at, among others. And then the other one where Damon has a more significant role is School Ties. And in both of those movies, as in a lot of movies that and TV roles that he's done, he's playing this sort of waspish character, but Cunningham, that is. but he does it well. So make of that as an interesting bit of trivia that I thought.
How about that? Okay, that was interesting. That was a good one.
Okay, so this is the part where we tell you that while Kiss Me Deadly and Starship Troopers are both available on DVD, Kiss Me Deadly is available on Criterion as well as regular DVD. And there have been a few editions of Starship Troopers on DVD as well. Kiss Me Deadly, as of now, is not available to stream anywhere, though it does show up on Turner Classic Movies from time to time. So if you subscribe to that or TCM now, keep your eyes peeled for it.
Now, TCM usually stays up to date. So do they have the post-97 version where you do see the house burn down and they
yes.
get out? Okay.
Yes. Now, Starship Troopers, on the other hand, is currently streaming on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And if you don't subscribe to Netflix, you could rent or buy it from Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, and other streaming services.
Okay, and what's coming up next time around?
Well, for the next two episodes, we're going to do something a little different. Normally, we take two movies with different titles, which have a lot in common, including a singular theme that we talk about. In our next two episodes, we're going to be talking about movies that have almost nothing in common, except for the fact they have the same title.
Mm.
We're going to start out with two different movies called No Way Out. One is from 1950 and was directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. The other is from 1987 and was directed by Roger Donaldson. And both of these movies are available on DVD, possibly Blu-ray as well. At least I know No Way Out is. The 1950 No Way Out, you can rent or buy from Amazon. Well, you can rent from Amazon, Google Play, DirecTV, Vudu, and YouTube. Or you can buy it from any of those services, as well as Apple TV. Whereas the 1987 No Way Out, you can currently stream on Max, as HBO Max is now called, or Max if you subscribe to it through Amazon or DirecTV, or you can watch it for free with ads on Tubi, or you can rent or buy it from Amazon, Apple TV, and most other streaming services.
All right.
And we have our own website, Words and Movies Pod, wordsandmovies.com, excuse me, and you can email us with a comment or question through wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com, or you can comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/wordsandmovies. And Sean Gallagher, myself, I am also on Facebook. And how about you, Claude?
Well, you can find me on the Book of Face under my own name, Claude Call, or you can check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com.
Okay, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.
Yes, thank you very much. Alex, please take us out.
This is your announcer, Alexander Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Spotify for podcasters. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.